Well, I'll start off.
I'd argue.
I'll start off by saying that, in my opinion, the prosecution should not have the burden of proof. And even if you feel that it should, I do not I object to the manner of stating it. In other words, you say it's an affirmative defense, and then you turn right around and say, but the minute that some evidence comes in, the burden is upon the prosecution. If you want that result, namely that when the defendant brings in some evidence, the burden is on the prosecution, I think you ought to say that, just that way, rather than saying that it's an affirmative defense. Because when you say something's an affirmative defense, normally you mean you're talking in terms of the burden of proof, who has the burden. So on a drafting basis, I would think we could say it better, but on the substantive issue, I would be opposed. I think that the burden is where it ought to be. I'm inclined to favor the way it is now, by a preponderance rather than beyond a reasonable doubt. But I don't see anything that's such an abuse as to require the shift. That'd be my opinion.
Let me respond just to the point of use of the word affirmative defense. I think that this is, it's used because of the definition in the Model Penal Code of affirmative defense, which defines affirmative defense in the manner in which you say it ought to be defined. And that's why I didn't put it in here, because it is defined in section 1.12 of the Model Penal Code, and those are the first sentence of my summary. Therefore, I am relying on a definition now in the Model Penal Code, of course, which may not be in our definition, and this would need adjustment if adopted at a later time, where an affirmative defense was defined differently in Article 1.
Thank you. Question about what affirmative defense is. We get to that point in the situation. But, I mean, that's what I understood to be that when you say affirmative defense, you're using the.
Yeah, this is used in Oregon law, does not achieve what I intended to achieve. But as used as defined in the Model Penal Code, it does.
Sure. I got to argue against that. Ordinarily, I wouldn't really care too much where the burden is. You're talking about fairness. In this state, at this time, I think this would be very unfair to the state. This is the reason our Supreme Court has joined, as usual, a minority of the Supreme Court's rank, which holds that the state, that the Fifth Amendment applies to psychiatric evaluations, so that if a person does give intent, a notice of intention to defend on the basis of insanity, our court holds that the state is entitled to require, or the court is, I should put it this way, the court may require the defendant to submit to psychiatric examination by the psychiatrist of the state's choice. However, the defendant, because of the Fifth Amendment, need not respond to anything. He can just sit there. So that when you say then that the state must take on the burden of proof, the Supreme Court has already taken away the tool by which the state can prove it. And we'd be absolutely stuck. We just couldn't do a thing, to carry that burden, unless the defendant, for some crazy reason, chose to cooperate.
The only way you can do it is have your own psychiatrist sit in the courtroom and have him
by hypothetical, and I find that very unsatisfactory.
Well, yeah, I agree. This would be the result, but it could be taken care of by further statutory provision to solve that problem. It would be a little difficult, but I think.
How are you going to solve a constitutional problem by statutory provision?
Well,
you could
provide the protections of the trial against this incriminating evidence. And I think that New Jersey does that, has a system of excluding evidence under a certain way. This is the New Jersey system was discussed in the Bowles case, I think, or Bowles case. Or the split trial system would avoid this, the bringing in split trial system with the insanity issue first, and that's what Wisconsin now does.
But didn't our court reject People versus Wolf in New Jersey case on the basis
that it did.
And it rejected it on constitutional grounds, saying that the information so obtained you know, we cannot say that it wouldn't be used in this way or that way. And therefore,
We don't know how the court would have come down had it had a different burden of proof problem, and that's one of the considerations in that Wisconsin case. Our court saw the allocation of burden of proof on the state instead of the defendant, it might have had a different response. And that's your speculation.
Yeah, but I think we're stuck with it now.
Yeah. Well, unless we change it by statute in some way.
Well, as a practical matter, I don't see how you can force a man to cooperate with a psychiatrist anyway.
You know, they do that in the District of Columbia under Durham. The state has a burden. The district has a burden. And also there, he need not cooperate. And this is one of the other problems that contributed to the filling up of St. Elizabeth's Hospital, you know, with people who didn't belong there. Because I mean, the state just can't fight it for that.
This is the thing. I mean, when it used to be that the defendant had to prove his insanity beyond a reasonable doubt, this, of course, created quite a burden maybe on the defendant. But just by a preponderance of the evidence, it means that the defendant has got to have some basic, sound evidence to present. Otherwise, he just as well not raise the issue. If the burden is on the the state to prove it, as long as there is just some evidence, this would mean that in many cases, the defendant can get his mother or his family just testify about what the judge is here in sentencing all the time. And about his background, and then the state is going to have to go forward to prove. And it seems to me that the real word is now. It means that before the defense, it probably doesn't prevent all frivolous defenses of insanity ways. At least it means that they've got to have some foundation for it. They've got to be able to have some psychiatrist who is willing to testify that the person is insane before they will raise the issue. And,
One of the views taken recently by the Colorado court, by the way, has reversed the long years of holding and now holds as a constitutional matter that the state must prove sanity beyond a reasonable doubt. The majority of the court put it on the basis of peculiarities of due process in Colorado. But the dissent pointed out, or the concurring opinion pointed out, that it wasn't that basis at all. It was really right. And the philosophy being that sanity, or insanity, is an element of a criminal offense. And therefore, since it is an element, since it's involved in mens rea, it is an element of the offense and must be proved beyond reasonable doubt by the state. That's the Colorado position at this point. And I think that this argument has been made once or twice in Oregon, but it's never been...
Once the Supreme Court of the United States said Lindlin, they said you didn't have to.
Yeah, the state is free to choose if it wants to what its own due process means. It doesn't violate federal due process. Well, this was a Colorado Supreme Court decision.
I'm not so sure Lindlin would be decided the same way if it went up today.
Yes, I wonder. One wonders whether the court would still feel the same.
Well, I know they defined certiorari in a few such cases. That isn't an indication of how they decide that they have.
Means at least they don't want to decide.
It means at least they don't want to.
But I still think at this juncture, and given the fact that it's still a matter of psychiatric expert witnesses, in the ordinary case where it's a serious question, where it's seriously asserted, it's still a matter of you getting a psychiatrist on one side and then state gets in one on the other, and you have at it, and I'm still of the opinion that overall fairness, that to put the burden on the defendant isn't an unfair proposition to him.
I'd like to point out a historical fact also to consider. The burden of proof got on the defendant, if you all recall, in 1864, when there was no rule that the defendant must give notice of his insanity defense. And not until 1937 in this state, as a matter of fact, was the defendant required to tip the state, if it didn't already know, that he was going to be fined or he was going to defend on insanity. So, in other words, historically, when there was no rule of notice, there was more reason to place that burden on the defendant because to pop it on the state at the trial was deemed unfair. The ALI, by the way, in its 1930, one of its early codes of criminal procedure, agrees with that, that there ought to be a notice statute, and in fact, Oregon's notice statute is modeled on that provision.
Of course, the notice feature this is a kind of an offshoot in a way, that the notice feature is essentially, it seems to me, designed to remove the sporting theory part of it, as opposed to where you place the burden. Seems to me that where you place the burden is the more important decision, and the idea of giving notice is just a matter that you're going to bring in some kind of an expert, while the other fellow ought to have his own expert, and procedurally it's a lot cleaner to let us know about it ahead of time. They've done the same. They've tried to do the same thing in alibi, and this
some
sort of
states
thing.
Do that.
Some states do. We haven't done it here, but ultimately, you can't. It seems to me you can't stack the cards too heavily against the state. It
comes down on what you want to do with the individual, I suppose. If you stack the cards against the state and they fail to prove sanity, then the individual is put into the remedial process, in the mental institution, the medical process as we know it now. If the state is successful in proving sanity, then of course he's thrown into the criminal process. And that has very different results, as we've seen.
Well, that would appear to be a mistaken assumption.
Yeah,
it would very well be.
From this, that he goes into the medical process, because currently, practically experienced, this doesn't actually happen.
The ones that go into the medical process, go into the mental institutions, are those that are usually there because they are, there's no question about their insanity, and they're either there because they're not confident, or that the state would go ahead and stipulate that they are insane, because all the psychiatrists agree that the person is insane. Really what this does is open the door to those persons who are not really mentally ill, and so they would not end up in the medical hospital. They would end up being excused for their act without ending up anywhere.
You know that either side in an adversary system, as Jake mentioned a little bit ago, either side is going to push it to the very limits, and particularly in the context of our country today, it is going to be the defense lawyer who's going to push it. I mean, that's what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to push these things just as far as he can. And I would anticipate that you'd find a considerable increase in insanity contentions, particularly where so many of the cases you go in and get a fellow appointed, the guy doesn't have money to pay for it, so the court appoints a psychiatrist, and probably it's a good idea and so on, but I think you'd find a sizable increase in the number of these cases where all you've got to do is just throw a little evidence in, and then there's the burden on the state.
What would you do about the partial responsibility?
You mean that's the burden? Well, leave it the way it is.
Well, there is a presumption.
I would leave the burden exactly where it is on that case.
Well, that's what we're debating, the difference between an affirmative defense and the burden of proof. Mm-hmm. Is that what we're debating?
See, I make the observation that I appear to be all alone here. It makes me feel more isolated than an ivory tower. You know, sometimes I get that feeling. I guess there are no voices here that agree with this at all.
I don't have strong feelings, let's put it that way. I'm distressed as ambiguous about the Fifth Amendment problem. And I don't have strong feelings about either way. I'm not having them at that
time. Well, a court or a legislature, whatever it is, gets to the point where they're saying that the state does have the burden of proof on this thing, then they certainly are going to be confronted with two conflicting constitutional problems, the due process and the Fifth Amendment. There is certainly a very distinct, at least members of our court felt, very distinct Fifth Amendment problem in compelling a defendant to answer any and all questions that the psychiatrist may put to him. That in the absence of some means by which this could be kept absolutely confidential from prosecution or anywhere being used against him, that the hazard is just too great. Now, so that if you say that, well, due process requires that the state have this burden, then there's going to have to be some way worked out to avoid the Fifth Amendment so that, as Jay points out, the state has some means of at least talking to the man. And even though you talk to him, this doesn't mean certainly that you're going to be able to reach the man. I don't care actually whether he's a defense-appointed psychiatrist or a prosecution-appointed psychiatrist. There's going to be so many people that just won't cooperate with any of them. The so-called psychopath, he just won't function in any of them. But by and large, the smart guy who wants to try and prove he's insane for the purposes of being acquitted, he just will dummy up in front of a court-appointed or a prosecution-appointed psychiatrist. I don't care who he is. So that as a practical matter, it would seem to me like that until such time as an authoritative court says that its due process requires this, it would seem to me like that the burden should be where the evidence is available, and that is for the defense.
Well, Judge, what would you think about the Wisconsin approach, where the psychiatrist is entitled by the Supreme Court of Wisconsin says that the defendant must answer all questions the state psychiatrist asks. But in exchange for that, we see the great Fifth Amendment problem with incrimination. Therefore, we now establish in these kind of cases where the state has insisted on the psychiatrist who wants to talk to the defendant, in those kind of cases, we will try insanity first. Not guilt, not the act, but insanity first.
Well, that was argued in the case we had.
Perhaps to a
jury. And it may be that was an answer. But this is the kind of thing that would require legislation.
Yes, right. And of course, then the second trial, if in fact it's found sane, in the second trial, the court would exclude all evidence of the psychiatrist's conversation.
Except that you may have this partial responsibility.
But even in that case, I get the feeling that Wisconsin law didn't reach it, that they would exclude it. Which might be a...
Well, does Wisconsin reject partial responsibility, or do you know?
I don't know which way they are on that particular situation, because they did not discuss, I think significantly, ignored the issue of mens rea in the concept of responsibility. They didn't reach that at all. All they were addressing themselves to was this problem of incrimination under the Fifth Amendment, where you're talking about a psychiatrist and a defendant. And I think that they're going to have the same problems later. They'll start realizing that they've gotten themselves some new problems that they certainly didn't talk about there.
How important is partial responsibility doctrine in Oregon? I mean, in practical effect, if we did go for the Wisconsin procedure, trying the insanity question first.
Of course, I'm not think that going to the Wisconsin system would be a very substantial change in our procedure here, and I'm not at all sure to be able to sell it very well. And I can't see getting into that change just to avoid, just to arrive at a fair decision on this question here. It seems to me that the number of insanity cases to begin with are small, as we all recognize or should. And the positive harm, it seems to me, that you do with extremely small or remote. Telling the defendant, okay, you say you're insane, you gotta prove it. You don't have the same beyond reasonable doubt, but you gotta prove it. You gotta sell the jury. In context, this time in 1968 in the United States of America, the state of Oregon, this doesn't seem to me to be unfair.
In my role as an officer of the court and a servant of the court, I think I should cite to the court authority against my position with respect to Wisconsin on this very point. Wisconsin has a cafeteria system, very interesting. On the defendant has a choice in Wisconsin. He may defend not guilty by reason of insanity using the McNaughton test, or he may defend not guilty by reason of insanity using the Model Penal Code test. But if he takes the Model Penal Code test, in Wisconsin, by a Supreme Court rule, he must bear the burden of proof to a preponderance. If he takes McNaughton, the state has the burden beyond reasonable doubt. Interesting situation.
Right. Your notice of insanity is...
This seems interesting that Wisconsin thinks that the Model Penal Code is an easier rule to succeed on, and therefore mm-hmm. to take something away from the defendant by making it tougher for him to prove.
Interesting to know what process, procedure, and so on they adopted that rule, or what prompted.
I haven't read the case that it was based on.
It was a court-made rule. Was it a sensational rule?
It was a decisional rule, yes. Right. Not in the case that I'm talking about. It had occurred prior to the case. That wasn't the issue in this particular case on the criminality or the Fifth Amendment. But the cases were cited in the decision, the Wisconsin decision from which this rule came.
I would assume it would come within the rulemaking power.
Very recent, I think.
I'm trying to think of how I would explain that to my mother. She asked me about the law.
Which has had the most takers, George, you know? Are there any...
Which rule?
Yeah, I mean, which route?
Goldstein says that the ALI is the rule, is the way of the future. He thinks it's very reasonable because it bears forward the historical traditional concept.
Well, I mean in Wisconsin, you know?
I'm sorry, in Wisconsin.
As far as...
I don't know. Sorry. I'm going off on too much. The MBC is coming in more jurisdictions all the time, of course. That doesn't mean that Oregon should take it, but it is evidently being found workable in more and more jurisdictions.
The Model Penal Code,
yes. And in many, if not most, of the federal districts don't have Model Penal Code.
Case one of these days if the U.S. Supreme Court looks at it and tell us that ALI is due process.
That's a different way of heading up.
Maybe this isn't the proper way to handle it. We haven't disposed of number one. At least it's number two. I don't mean to make Professor Platt feel so lonely.
I'm with 20 other states.
But I I would be opposed to Section 2. And I don't, I would be in favor of leaving the burden where it is now, by preponderance of the evidence.
I would second that.
Or a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Or a recommendation?
Question.
All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Opposed? Put me down. Opposed? That one. Professor Platt.
Well, I must say, in conclusion, that I feel better about things in general, having heard the practical applications of the sanity rules here in Oregon. Although this is lost to me in a sense, I don't feel the sense of loss that I would have before the conversation started. Federal Supreme Court rule for federal circuit is beyond a reasonable doubt by the Constitution. But that has not been imposed on the states. So you're against the United States Supreme Court again, gentlemen. They thought the best rule was this formulated here.
Well, you have one big, tremendous difference in the federal system you must recognize, which again is a practical thing. That is the ability of the trial judge to comment on the evidence. Mm-hmm. And that makes a tremendous difference in the trial case of this kind, even for this kind of issue where the burden of proof is. Because if the trial judge sees fit and can comment on the testimony involved in this kind of thing, it would make a tremendous difference on what would happen in the trial case.
The only difference, too, is the nature of crimes involved, because if an insanity plea is uncommon or in, you know, not common in Oregon, it's far less common in federal criminal trials, now excluding the District of Columbia or Guam or a place like that. Because after all, you just can't carry off an insanity defense in a fraud case or tax evasion or bank robbery or possibly mail theft. About the only place we'd come up with any merit, and there have been defenses of this nature, but they never get anywhere. The only place we'd come up with merit would be traditional state-type crimes on Indian reservations or
federal reservations,
federal parks,
or so they get murdered and raped.
Yeah. So I mean, it's a very uncommon thing there, I think. They
almost invariably in Oregon it's come up in murder one charges, and that of course because it preceded the ending of the capital punishment statute. But there has been a very recent case that was one of the exceptions to that is charged with assault and robbery. Very rare to get in the United in our Supreme Court, at least that far up, a charge other than a capital punishment or a cumulative. This may have been accumulating situation, a five-time loser or something. So it probably was.
Crimes of impulse, rape, murder, assault. But we definitely every now and then in the burglary case we have one coming up this week in a check case of all things. So forged a check. Found a psychiatrist. And I could find a couple psychiatrists that would say any one of the people in this room were crime were you to commit one.
I think it was a check case, and the rule which probably binds us with respect to who can insert the insanity defense. I think it came up in D.C. Not sure, but anyhow, I got off the Supreme Court. The defendant was a check writer, and he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, and he couldn't have gotten more than a year if he'd been found guilty. And I think the state in the District of Columbia proved that he was insane. They wanted to prove he was insane for some reason. And they inserted, in short, the insanity defense. He did not. And that was approved until it got to the United States Supreme Court, which indicates that the only person who can introduce the defense of insanity is the defendant. Now, that's not a peripheral matter, really. It does have something to do with our overall problems. Ought that to continue to be the rule in Oregon? And if we change it, would it stand muster in the United States Supreme Court? Can we deprive the defendant of his right to control his defense?
Well, in D.C., that depends, it seems to me, on the fact that the only way he would get out of the hospital was by having a court hearing and the judge let him out. So, with that in mind, that would kind of, since we don't have that, it says you'd have to have a judge let you out, maybe it isn't important as to who raised the consent issue. I'm not answering it, I'm just suggesting a distinction.
Yeah.
Okay, shall we move on to section three?
Well, section three, I don't think was all that difference in the Oregon law, with the exception of what to do, whether the time of the act should control with respect to jurisdiction, or whether the time of remand should control. And Oregon, of course, follows the rule that it's the age at remand, not the age of the act. And this would change that rule and allow the 15-year-old not, or prohibit the 15-year-old from being held by the juvenile court until he was 16, so that they can remand him to the circuit court.
Change the rule of the little case, though.
Yes, change the little. I don't think it's. I think this is the best rule to follow this. In the interest of justice and speedy trials and all the other indications in the Model Penal Code comment, but this is the rule. But little is not the best rule to follow. But even if you accept and reinsert the little rule, then of course you have exactly the same kind of situation reflected by this draft as well as the law in Oregon now.
Go ahead. Excuse me. I was going to. What are the arguments against little? Just that you keep the kid around and wait until you can ready whack him.
Right. The arguments are that as a matter of our historical jurisprudence and philosophy, a man is entitled to a swift trial, and that if you sit on him for any period of time, and he could for a couple of years, presumably, stall around not bringing him in until he passed 16. But this works an unfair burden on that particular accused.
Is there another rationale that's behind that, and that is that the reason you choose to treat this individual differently and potentially in a less a punitive fashion is because of his very youth and inability maybe to understand all of these acts, and if you make the treatment based on the age he is when he comes to court rather than the age he was when he committed this act, which is causing all these difficulties, you have changed somewhat the rationale of the whole juvenile jurisdiction.
Yeah.
It has changed by now.
It's true.
I don't know what the rationale of the juvenile act is anymore, but if it's a when they're under the age of 18, unless they are remanded, that while they are young and are more amenable, supposedly, to rehabilitation, you rehabilitate them in this fashion in the juvenile code, under the juvenile code. But if they aren't and aren't going to be rehabilitated, I guess if that's the term, under the juvenile code, then let's treat them as adults. And you say let's keep the jurisdiction in the juvenile court, but suppose the kid is 17 with 2 months to go until 18. What purpose, as far as being able to rehabilitate them all, is the juvenile court going to be able to do with this individual? Nothing. So that his age at the time of remand, I think the little case, although it allowed it in this case, that the state isn't going to be able to sit back forever, I mean, like say 2 years, then they're going to have problems with the speedy trial. But that it seems to me that the age of the remand should control. And I point out to you earlier, George, that under this wording, a person who commits a crime at the age of 15, let's say little, who committed the crime at the age of 15, had he not been apprehended until after he reached the age of 18, he would not be prosecutable in any way under this statute?
Oh, no.
Under this. He's a juvenile.
No, he'd be over 18.
He'd be over 18.
Oh, he'd be over 18.
So that he was 18 when, if Little had been, if they hadn't solved the case until Little was 18, then all that the state would have been able to do would be to release something in the paper and say, Little killed the girl. And then, if Little wanted to contest it, I suppose let him sue him for slander or something and prove that he killed the girl in that type of a situation. But the way this is worded, that is all that could be done.
No, I disagree. We've talked about this a little. In your fact situation, child 15 commits murder, for which there's no statute of limitations, if I'm correct in that. He's not apprehended until he's 22, let's say. The Peyton case, somebody mentioned that the situation 8 years elapses before there's an arrest. All right, he's 22 years old. And under our code now, and under this code, the juvenile court would not have jurisdiction. Under existing Oregon law, and I'm not sure about this, but I doubt if anybody knows what the answer is, but at any rate, there's a specific provision here that a person shall not be tried or convicted of an offense if at the time of the conduct charged to constitute the offense he was 16 or 17, unless
yes.
Juvenile court has no jurisdiction over him.
Yes, if he were 16 and had committed murder and were not apprehended until he was 22, he could be prosecuted for murder. But if he is 15, under Section A, the only possible way that he could be treated would be as a juvenile, and only if he was apprehended under the age of 18, and then they could keep him under control until 18, or theoretically until 21, and I suppose that for the protection of society, they would keep a person like Little in McLaren up until the age of 21, although they don't want him there.
Professor? I agree with Frank's interpretation of the draft. This is what the law would be. I'm very much disturbed by this proposition. You take Little at his age, and you remand him to try as an adult. Our present law simply doesn't say how far back you could go and do the same thing, does it? If he had been 14, if he had been 13, if he had
There is an age. 16 years.
You have to be 16 to be remanded to adult court.
If he's under that, he has to be handled as a juvenile.
Right.
You mean if he's under 16 and when he commits the offense, he could never be remanded?
Well, unless he reached the age, which is what happened until he reached the age of the remandable age.
I'm
during the time he was in custody.
Obviously, I don't know the present law, but assume that a boy is 15 when he commits the act. Are you saying the present law says that he cannot be remanded when he reaches 16?
No.
He can't be remanded. Well, no, but let's say that he's 14 when he commits the act. Are you saying that when he reaches 16,
he can be remanded, but he's got to reach 16.
Well, okay. But then actually you're getting into another problem if you get back down to, let's say, that he's 10 years old. Kills someone, and that the crime is not solved until he reaches the age of 16 to be remandable, or 18 over adult. Then you've got an entirely different problem, which of course is discussed in here, is just plain old, is a kid at the age of 10 years, is he criminally responsible?
We don't say anything about that now.
We'll say that a kid at the age of 10 years may not be criminally, we're not concerned when we've got a juvenile in at the age of 10 years whether he's criminally responsible. We're concerned about rehabilitation now. So you don't really get into the question under the juvenile code is whether or not a 10 year old can commit burglary or not. But you would.
Under the common law, you would.
Yeah, under the common law, you would. There's an age where a person is the same as insane. I mean, even though he commits an act, he's not responsible.
I'm not, apparently I'm being stupid. I'm not
Well, common law, I think it's a person, a child 7 years and under.
Yeah,
you could not possibly presume the incapable of forming intent. Under 14 is rebuttably.
And it's an increasingly strong probability that it would be found responsible. But now under our situation, if he's 15, it is a little case. If you wait till he's 16, you can remand him. Then he becomes responsible in the adult court. And,
well, the question of intent would still be an issue, or the question of capacity would still be
sure,
an issue.
Sure. Granted, what if he's 14?
I'm saying if you remand, if a kid committed murder when he was 2, and he was remanded when he was 16, the remand apparently would still be valid in the circuit court, the adult court would take jurisdiction. But in the circuit court, there's still the question of whether or not he was capable of forming necessary.
Sure, and we don't have any precise law. Illinois, you can have a law that said a 12 years period. If you're under 12, you just never could be prosecuted. Do we need something like that in Oregon? That's what I'm raising.
That it ought to be jurisdictional rather than a question of responsibility. The juvenile court should decide the disposition of the offender. Taking into consideration, I suppose, as an aspect of the case, how responsible the person was, but not in the common law sense of responsibility, where there was an absolute incapacity to commit crime.
Well, George, I think what I'm saying is this, that either we should abolish the little rule, or if we keep the little rule, we should set a precise age below which a child can't go to grammar. I think that's what Jake said a little bit ago.
Yeah, I see your point.
Two questions, very separate.
This abrogates the little rule. That's the choice this makes.
What does that mean? Question,
Frank. Yeah,
I don't know.
More than abrogates the little rule.
I don't know what the answer is. I think you're right about that, but I can't conceive of what the draft here is doing that wouldn't cover that situation. And we found a hiatus in the model penal code. Gee, that would be wonderful, wouldn't it, if we found the model penal code's name was there.
You don't understand how a 15-year-old who is not arrested until he's 18 couldn't be prosecuted?
Well, I agree with Frank on his interpretation of the draft.
I think you're correct, Frank. I'm agreeing with you that there is a hiatus with respect to that 15-year-old who isn't arrested until after he's 20. What's the impact of this draft on that? And I can't see for the life of me that it has an impact on him. I think you're right. And I don't mean for that result to be. I mean for that 15-year-old, if he reaches 22, to be amenable to regular criminal process, as he would be if he were 16 or 17 and got past that age before he was arrested. In other words, if he commits the crime when he's 4, conceivably, this would be a real wild one, but if he commits the crime at age 6, isn't arrested until age 20. Now, this is a professorial kind of hypothetical that we've done our students with, and that's not bringing up the commission.
Yeah, I mean, that's a capacity question.
We had a 5-year-old attack somebody with butcher knife, so that's...
But it would be known immediately.
Yeah, that's right. 5-year-olds
are going to be able to conceal his crime.
The statute of limitations.
It's a practical matter.
Well, don't we have two problems? One is, do we want to change the little rule? And number two, the drafting problem that Frank had mentioned, if little was so little as to escape notice for 3 years, he'd be off the hook completely. And I
certainly don't want that.
In other words, what about a 14 or 15-year-old kid who either hides or runs or isn't found out. Do you want the handling of him to be determined by the age when he is apprehended?
Well, that's the decision we have to make. Do we hand him back to the juvenile court at age 22, or do we put him in the straight criminal court? It doesn't make sense, really, at that advanced age, to put him back in the juvenile court.
If he escapes and you don't catch him until he's 19, then treat him as an adult.
That's
I don't see any problem with that.
He wants to do, intends to do. But
if you catch him, when he's 16 or 17, then you treat him like any other 16 or 17 year old. You either put him in juvenile or you remand him, depending on.
Well, under this, though, if he was 15 at the time he committed the act, if he was apprehended at the age of 17, he could not be remanded.
He could not.
Because he does away with little rule. Mm-hmm.
Well, if you just simply, instead of having all this, simply provide that a person shall be criminally responsible depending on the age at which he is at the time he is brought to trial.
Well, we may be cutting across then the juvenile code. Juvenile code is superimposed, as many codes are, on the old common law responsibility concept, and it has abrogated that. So in a sense, then, Judge, you would be reinserting the common law responsibility aspect, which the juvenile codes have abrogated.
Well, it may be that I've been wondering if whether or not this has any business in the criminal code at all or not. It should be in the juvenile code. The juvenile code,
if we make
on with the, as exemplified by the little case, there is something of a kind of a hiatus or a kind of an unanswerable sort of a problem involved in this thing we're talking about.
If we did nothing, if we enacted no section in the model penal code, the juvenile code of Oregon would cover this situation and we would have the little rule. You're absolutely correct. In a sense,
except
this is duplication of existing law.
Except
you're right. We don't really need to put this in at all. I feel that one reason for doing it is a comprehensive model penal code with respect to the responsibility concepts.
Except for competency, isn't it? I mean, wouldn't you still need a provision that a child under the age of 15 was not...
No, it was not.
You're suggesting that the common law is still in force?
No, it's abrogated by this provision of the juvenile code. It's a matter of jurisdiction, which court handles it.
How do you solve competency then?
No, I mean, say, the child commits murder at age 13 is not caught till he's 18. Wouldn't you still have to deal with that problem in the criminal code as opposed to the...
If he's caught at age 18 and he committed the crime at 13,
yeah, so
under this he'd have to be remanded. It could not be remanded in the circuit court.
Yes,
well, is he
coming? You still need a competency rule.
Over 17, yeah.
Saying that
yes.
A child is not responsible.
I'm getting confused, but I see what you mean. Should we have, after this has all occurred, but only with the particular offender who hasn't been caught within the time of the jurisdiction, ought there be a responsibility provision as to him, not to all offenders, but just as that particular one or class.
In effect, this draft puts that at age 16, doesn't it?
Yes.
It does. Yeah. But a possible criminal.
I wish I had, some states have high, some states have a responsibility age beginning at 16, I believe is the, and I'm not sure what states they are now, but
sure they do.
This information is available. Some states pick 14, below which there cannot, it's conclusively presumed there can't be a crime. Some say below 16, some say below 10, some 7. Those states have not adopted the jurisdictional approach in the model penal code.
Jordan, now maybe I don't understand your meaning of 1B, 1BA. But wasn't that put in there for the purpose of dealing with this kind of situation where you had someone that, say, committed a crime and then escaped jurisdiction for some reason?
It was.
Wasn't that intended to deal with that?
It was, and Frank says he doesn't think it does, and I'm inclined to think he's right.
Yeah,
because it says...
Over 16 or 17.
It doesn't say anything about the 15-year-old. You've got that B in there that precedes capital A. You've got small b that precedes capital A. And it seems that capital A applies only to sub small b and would not include the 15-year-old situation. I didn't mean for that to happen. I was accepting the model penal code as if it were the testament, and I'm in trouble over it, I think.
That's happened to many ministers accepting the other
one. Yes. I ought to know better because I drafted bills for a long time too.
Well, my personal feeling is that the ruling in the little case
exactly the little set. But if you're 15 years and 11 months when you commit the act, and the cancer, you're still less than 16, and you're in juvenile court custody, when you reach age 16, the juvenile court can remand you to the adult court and be tried as that.
Or they couldn't remand you at the age 15 when you commit the act.
It's a hard case, which I'm inclined to think might make bad law.
Well, I mean, but the little case, I think, makes clear that you couldn't take that the juvenile court couldn't take a 14-year-old into custody on a murder charge and hold him there in juvenile detention for 2 years until he got to be 16 and then remand him.
But you don't know what that is.
Say there is a
question. What did you
say that was a hard case?
No, the little case.
What
is makes clear that you've got a problem with rage murder in that. Yeah. And that the state can't unduly delay the proceedings until he gets to be 16 and then remand him because he's got his right to speedy trial. So
yeah.
The little case that wouldn't stand for authority for holding a 14-year-old until he gets to be 60 and then remand
him. And this is a question
for
until
fast. It has a period of time there that even though it was a period of what? 2.5 to 3 months.
The court was not making advantage of it either. They were simply interpreting a statute, which was pretty clear.
You know,
the statute wasn't clear.
I can see both sides of this, and I think we are at some impassable point. Let's go back to my 5-year-old. Supposing he had been successful with his butcher knife, and he had killed a little girl, and he was successful in concealing his crime, and he passed all these years, and at age 23, he finally thinks that the police are still working on this case and spending a lot of money, so he goes down and he confesses that he committed this crime at age 5. Now, there would be very little justice at that time in trying him in adult court at all.
I think we're all agreed on that. What are you going to say in the law that what age he has reached when he commits the act and have him not be responsible? Or are we going to leave it up to Greg?
Well, but are you taking because of his age of 5 and now 23? That being a period of 18 years is being reached by the little justice in trying him, or are you just...
I'm not sure you can try him under the adult court for an act he did when he was obviously a complete child.
Yeah. Didn't have the capacity.
Yeah.
But that's the same thing as the guy who's raising the insanity defense, that he is insane. Now, he's been in the state hospital for 10 years, and now he's competent to stand trial, and he's now sane, and so he goes in trial. But that doesn't prevent
him
from raising the insanity defense at that time.
If I were writing the opinion, I'm inclined to hold that since the juvenile code does not any longer apply, the old common law concepts of incapacity do apply to this particular man. We don't need a statute for the court to dispose of him to hold that at 5 he's inconclusively, or he's conclusively
on
that.
But
that would be a solution the court could bring.
All right, but it's 8, 7.5. Oh, we need a statute to cover that, I think. I can't conceive of
But the cases that arise, I admit that I suppose there are some 5-year-olds walking around with butch knives, but the cases that arise and the ones that trouble society are the little cases. Now, sure, there are not many little cases, but it happens from time to time. 14, 15-year-old kids commit serious offenses. And I think that you've got to make a real value judgment. What are you going to do with it?
I'm voting on the abolishment of the death penalty.
And
it's
in the news.
The problem with this is that the only time this really arises, like I say, is in the very serious cases, and in cases which I'm sure that Judge Ford took determining the remand in the little cases. What in the world is a juvenile court going to be able to do with this kid in the next 2 years if we do retain jurisdiction? And that it would be best for society that he be treated as an adult, so that he is convicted of it, that society can have the controls over him for the time necessary because of the crime he committed. I think it is possibly something, whether it be for us to consider here or whether it should be just in the juvenile code, that maybe in those more serious crimes, maybe the age of remand, possible remand, should even be lower.
Well, so well, you still have the same kind of case, the one that occurs too. You're drawing a line, and any time you draw a line, you're going to have some tough cases. And unfortunately, this little case is really a tough one. And undoubtedly, the first thing that's going to be said to the judiciary committees in both the Senate and the House is, what are you going to do about the little case situation? You can provide for allowing the little rule to stand, as you have indicated, by, in the statute, saying that the remand must be made before the expiration of a reasonable time. In other words, instead of the old fourth, I don't think we have the four-term rule in Oregon. It doesn't say reasonable time. All right, that moves the remand age from 16, it says 16, but it moves it back to whatever a reasonable length of time would be for the juvenile court to hold little, during which it may still remand. Now, would that satisfy the objections? Still retaining the age 16 and moving it back to get the 2, 3, or 3.5 month 15-year-old offender?
You mean by statute to set out when his right to a speedy trial rights, I mean a speedy determination or adjudication,
yeah,
whatever you
similar
call
type
it.
Provision within this particular. That would, it would certainly silence the objections that are going to be raised as a practical matter in the Senate and House Judiciary Committees, I'm sure.
Would you do the same thing just by lowering the age that can remand on?
No. Yes, you can. You put it back to 15 and a half, and then what if a little had been 15 in 4 months?
I see the problem French raised, but goodness, let's not make the present juvenile code more punitive than it is now.
And we're after the criminal law, not the juvenile code.
Yeah.
I think we should do a little hash to the other body of law.
Yeah, I agree.
Well,
no, I don't agree. Really, nothing
this,
wrong with
this. Does
there's nothing
wrong
with
the little rule. There's
nothing wrong with a little decision, other than the threat of the prosecution attempting to hold a child in juvenile court until such time as he reaches age and responsibility. And it seems to me like the other rules that are inherent in anything of this kind on speedy trial solves that question. And you simply are not going to be able to by legislation unless you just simply provide that in any case where a juvenile commits a crime and he's not apprehended or doesn't come to trial until the time he becomes an adult, his responsibility will be determined by the age at which he's brought to trial. That is, the court in which he is tried, not his responsibility. If you want to make some statute of that kind. But otherwise, it seems to me like the little rule, plus the requirement that he be brought to trial, and that there can only be a reasonable time at which they can hold him.
We assume, and I think properly, that the speedy trial is a part of the due process which will extend to juveniles, and I assume that probably will. Well, I don't think anybody has said, the United States Supreme Court hasn't had that particular issue, has it?
You said a college professor for speedy trial case.
You use that one.
Mm-hmm.
You use that one.
What do you think, Professor Platt, you can synthesize something out of this discussion?
Well, I'm not sure yet whether you want the little rule or not.
I'm in favor of the little decision. I would oppose Section 3 insofar as it changes the little result. And that's my position.
There's another control over little, other than just as far as the prosecution holding this kid until he reaches a remandable age, and that is the juvenile court is going to be able to make that decision as to whether or not it's going to be remanded. It's not the prosecution going to be holding back to be assured of any remand, unless the court is in cahoots with
it. Well, that's true, but we still have some non-law trained
juvenile court judges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't see why it's all needed. I think you're complicating it very much. Now maybe it's just because I don't see the problems. Two completely separate questions. One is jurisdiction of the court, and that is taken care of by the juvenile code. I don't think it has to be mentioned very much. The other question is capacity. And capacity could be handled very simply by codifying the common law as to capacity or changing the ages involved in the common law. Simply by saying, you know, when tried in adult court, or language to that effect.
As a result of having reached adult age.
Why do you even have to say it? How else could he have gotten
there? You apply to all offenders.
How else could he have gotten there? Except that way. If you want that language, you can, but I think you complicate it.
Yes,
as long as
that's what
you're referring to circuit court as opposed to juvenile.
The point I'm making, Jake, is that if you reassert more or less the common law incapacity to commit crime situation without limiting it to these particular class of people that have committed the crime at an early age and not caught till afterward, then you are undoing the Juvenile Court Act.
Well, I'm saying it should be clear in some manner that it is applicable only to
this particular class that have gone past age 17 when they're arrested. Yeah, well, okay.
When they're tried. Where the circuit court is taking jurisdiction over charge of crime? Because in juvenile court, you're not prosecuting for a crime. He's not being held responsible for a crime.
I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be complimentary. In short, when he's in the circuit court, there's going to be an incapacity provision to cover this very unusual situation where he committed the crime at a very young age.
Are you prepared to suggest an age, Jake?
13, Berlin stuff.
Well, that's not it.
Now we got a First Amendment question.
Yeah. Well, with that comment, it'll meet with your approval, and if you try to do that,
right.
Make that approach, perhaps, and we're going to have at least one more meeting on Section 1.
I think that's the rule. We can come back to isn't that really the law now? If you're tried in circuit court on a criminal charge, the old common law.
If it is, I'm not sure of it, but
I think the only purpose of changing it is to change the ages.
Oh.
You know, codify it and change the ages. If one is happy with the ages in the common law, I think you can omit it.
Now, we've got a problem. If we're going to meet with anybody, and I don't know what you all feel, if we're going to meet with anybody from the psychiatric profession, it might be better to have a subcommittee meeting in Portland. We might be able to get them to attend easier. What do you think, Jim?
Fine with me, then. I don't want to disagree.
I don't know whether we want. Do you want to hear more psychiatric expertise? I think we just about our own feelings on it, but perhaps you want to consult with them from the point of view of winning them over, whatever we do.
I think it'd be helpful to hear some of them on this. I mean, because really we haven't, as far as whether the ALI or whether we should stick with the McNaughton or certain changes in McNaughton, we really haven't just, we've discussed, but we haven't, at least I don't feel that we've come to any point where we've made a decision on it, so I think it would be helpful to hear.
Would it be possible for you? All
the time. Well, I make this observation. I agree. Any psychiatric testimony here is helpful. But number one, psychiatrists are probably the busiest of the doctors, and the doctors and those are busy. Would it not perhaps be better to wait until the full commission gets our recommendations to have them in, so the full commission gets the benefit of the psychiatrist testimony rather than here and then having them come back again? Can we impose ourselves that much on these very busy men?
I think that probably makes sense. I feel reasonably sure that it would be better to have that meeting in Portland, but I'd agree. And I must say that from a selfish standpoint, to hear the clash and clamor I'd just soon hear it once, frankly, instead of twice.
I think you're right.
I'm going to hear it as a member of the subcommittee and the full commission as well. I just shouldn't do it the one time only. I think it's valuable to hear it, but by the full commission.
I think the full commission will want to hear it. Well, what about a subcommittee meeting? I don't know. What else have we got besides this that will be coming up next?
Well, Courtney, of course, has some further materials that will be coming to this.
Are they ready?
They're not ready, and I'm embarrassed by that. Our school started on Labor Day, and I don't know when they'll be ready. I should be able to tell you right now they'll be ready in 3 weeks, Aaron, but I don't know. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
I'm
and in addition to this material, which of course we'll want to rework, I have finished about 3/4 of the inchoate crimes article. But I'm now in a fast approaching position that Courtney's in. Our school starts September 30th. Now, it's my sincere and fervent hope to have the draft and explanations of the inchoate article ready before school starts. Now, I can't guarantee that, but at least I want you to know that I have this coming along, which is reaching a point where I can look at a time and say it's going to be done pretty soon. And this will be a major consideration for this subcommittee, too.
Yeah.
After this material.
Well, do you want to, the purposes of the next subcommittee meeting, do you want to go ahead with inchoate crimes, or do you want to?
Well, I don't think I'd be ready the next time for inchoate crimes. I just wanted to let you know that it's in the works and it's coming along pretty well, but I may get slowed down.
Well, with that in mind, I think it'd be well if we could have another subcommittee meeting on this material that we had here today before school starts for you.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. Actually, whatever you decide isn't going to be an awful lot of work for me now. Unless you want to go into, and there's something else to consider, I think, in the interim. The dealing with the offender after he has been found not guilty by reason of insanity, no matter how we do it, or dealing with him after the issue of competency to stand trial has been decided, are, in a sense, strictly procedural matters that have very heavy impact on the substance of our general subject, not the rule we choose. I don't think it makes any difference about that. So you have a choice now of postponing those kind of hard decisions until you get to the procedural aspect of the code, or keeping them in a bundle with the substantive part that we're now thinking about and trying to get them out of the way now, trying to come to the conclusion as a matter of policy that we ought to provide a different way for committing or a different method of dealing with these people once they have been adjudicated somewhere or the other. So you have a policy choice there, in addition to the choice of what specific way you want to deal with.
I think in view of the time, we're just about going to confirm.
Well, they're so closely related.
Yeah, that's the problem. We're actually, if we wait until later, we're going to be kind of rehashing the insanity issues, kind of.
Yeah, it's
maybe 3 years.
It seems to me this almost has to be an exception to our the decision that was made to defer any procedural work until after we finish the substantive, because I think we're gonna have an awful difficult time later on when we come back to it.
Yes.
If we postpone any action on it until we get the procedure.
All right, next question. When could you meet?
Anytime.
2 weeks would be enough.
Oh, yeah.
Do you all
actually, I have. You have not yet directed me what you want to do with this juvenile code thing.
Section 3.
Yeah, Section 3. I get a gist of what your feeling is, but we haven't talked about specific age as far as capacity goes.
Well, I think the age.
Do you want to leave that open until next time?
Blank, but I think we want to approach it much. General consensus is from the age. From the age viewpoint, leave both alone.
All right, let me sum up so that I'll be able to draft, I hope, what you want. The draft is presented in the Model Penal Code, taking the jurisdictional approach to the average kind of case where the kid has been apprehended before he reaches age 18. Is acceptable, except you want to incorporate the little rule in it to pick up that pre-16 age so that the court can keep him long enough to remain. Is that correct?
I thought we meant that in favor of the juvenile court code, which already has it.
All right. Leave the whole thing out.
Jurisdiction.
And provide only then a provision on the capacity of a person once he is tried in the circuit court. No matter how he gets there or when he gets there, capacity depending on when he committed the crime.
Don't even need to say circuit court in my opinion, because
why
the
district court or this way, yes,
I mean, adult court.
They need a better generic term, criminal courts. The court with criminal, general with criminal jurisdiction.
Right.
Well, in that case, I'll draft one and leave the ages blank, or select a statute from somewhere else and stick the age in, and you can switch it around and suit yourself.
All right. Well, the next question is, do you all prefer Saturday meetings, or are there lots of ball fans?
Be careful once we get into the fall.
We're rapidly approaching football season.
I think a lot of football, but I want to raise a technical question. 2 weeks from today is probably the October about April, I'm not sure.
Very important
ones.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, 2 weeks would be the 21st. That is, we want to meet on Saturdays. And next week, subcommittee number one is meeting, so that we... And the 28th, there's a ball game. I don't know how this...
How about the... How about Friday the 19th? Or the Friday the
20th?
That'd be great.
When is full committee going to meet, Tom?
No, we won't be meeting again for a while until we generate enough work from the subcommittees to...
Justice Bowman.
Big Bird,
could you come on Friday afternoon?
I'd do my best to, right?
What about you, Jay?
Probably.
Why don't we try for two weeks from yesterday then?
In the afternoon.
What's
the date?
Friday, September 20th.
At 1:30,
it's
still
crowded time. I think 1:30 is fine.
Let me ask as an administrative matters inspector, how long would it take to get these minutes out for my reference? Is it just too much imposition within that next just 2 week period? I don't know what your loads are, and just as a general point of interest.
Friday the 19th at 1:30. Is that 19th or 20th?
20th.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
We'll return.
Nice. So are
you? The gentleman who was here left here. It's a rather interesting communication.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you...
I wondered if he was a member of the...
Were you going to invite the same...